The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly...
Dear friends,
I'm wondering.
I want to welcome you all to our working lunch. And really it's a great honor and pleasure for us to receive here Mark Schneider. As you can read in the description that we made of the different speakers, Mark Schneider is a senior vice president, special advisor of Latin America at the International Crisis Group and directs its Washington office. For you who are not aware, the Crisis Group presents some of the most interesting analysis of situations related to crisis in the world. And really, the richness of this analysis and the presentation of different policy options are for some of us a material that is of tremendous need. So I will use the time also to mention this, and again you would recognize the hand of Mark Schneider in this materials, and you could recognize his hand because of his tremendous expertise in different areas for the purposes of contributing in the formulation of public policies. Mark Schneider served as the Peace Corps Director from 1999 to 2001. He was the USAID Assistant Administrator for Latin America and the Caribbean from 1993 to 1999. He was the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights from 1977 to 1979, Foreign Policy Advisor of Edward Kennedy from 1977 to 1976. And he worked in the realm of international organization, heading the strategic planning at PAHO, WHO, from 81 and 93. Before that, he was a Peace Corps volunteer in El Salvador, has a degree, a BA from UC Berkeley, and MA from San Jose State University. His presentation today and to his professional activities, the tremendous knowledge of the work in which the government functions, Congress, think tanks, and so on. And I would like to say also that Mark Schneider is well distinguished by the fact that he's an alum of this university. He had an honorary doctorate of law from the Washington College of Law in recognition for his contributions against the formulation of public policy and human dignity. He has the Human Rights Awards from Chile's government, the Bernardo Higgins distinction, which is the highest distinction given by that country, and a Public Service Award from the University of Rochester. That's a little bit his official resume of what we have composed as an official resume. Let me share with you that I met Mark around 1978. These were gloomy days when this region we had a lot of dictatorship, and life appeared very distant, and the possibilities of recovering democracy and so forth. And Mark Schneider, in his position of Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights, appeared at that time in Geneva and in New York, doing representing the position of the United States to promote the compliance with human rights. And that was a tremendous change. I mean, I don't know whether he remembers, but in the struggle, for example, to stop disappearances, we got a clear, convincing, tremendous support at that time from the U.S. administration. And again, we were part of a group doing lobby for human rights, the development of the machinery of the United Nations. And at that time, Mark Schneider represented to us that this is something that the United States would do anything and everything to stop it and influence, and not accepting this international plan. So we are honored and pleased that he's here. There are very few people that can talk more about the U.S. and the prohibition against torture and historic perspective, because he has been part of that history and he has been the best part of that. So, Mark Schneider, I invite you to the floor. Thank you.
Of First, let me express my appreciation to Claudio for that kind introduction. And we've been friends for a long time, as you've heard, and Claudio has introduced me at various events. However, I have noticed that since I became a member of the Board of Trustees of American University, the introductions have become somewhat longer and more abusive and a little bit more exaggerated. But in any case, I want to thank Claudio and the law school and the Association for the Prevention of Torture for inviting me to participate in this conference today. And I'm also honored to appear in place of Congressman Jim McGovern, who I understand was unfortunately delayed in Massachusetts. Jim has been a leading advocate in respect for human rights throughout his career. Now, as Claudio mentioned, the International Crisis Group pursues, and what distinguishes us is we pursue field-based inquiries into the drivers of conflict in some 60 countries around the world. And what we found is that gross violations of individual human rights, and particularly the use of torture, constitute a major cause for both internal and international conflict, and a major obstacle to reconciliation in the aftermath of conflict. And as we talked about what I might focus on today, I thought I'd try and give a little bit of a historical perspective at the way the United States has dealt with the prevention of torture over the years. Traditionally, I believe that the principle espoused by the United States has been to reject the use of torture and other cruel and unusual punishment. It's the rule accepted in law and endorsed by the American people. Unfortunately, there have been numerous exceptions in practice. And each time that they occur, they demean this country, they damage our image and our interests, and increase risks to our own troops and to our citizens. Now, we're at a unique moment. To some degree, your presence here today, the work of the Association, of UN Special Rapporteur Manfred Novak, of a strong UN Committee Against Torture, chaired by Claudio, of numerous domestic and international human rights organizations, civil society groups, constitute a powerful force committed to ending torture. It's a unique moment as well because President Barack Obama, I think, is on our side. He's placed himself squarely behind those who seek an absolute end to the use of torture. Not sometimes, not except for extreme circumstances, not for a temporary period, not for prisoners of war, not for terrorists, not for enemy non-combatants, not in Guantanamo, not in Abu Ghraib, not in Bagram, but nowhere, no time, no one should be tortured. Torture violates United States law. It violates international common law. It violates international human rights norms, and it violates legally binding treaties. 2 days after his inauguration, President Obama signed executive orders on detention interrogation policy with 16 generals and admirals standing beside him. And I gather that David Danzig, who just spoke with you, was instrumental in organizing those admirals and generals. Now, those orders directed the closing of the Guantanamo-based detention facility, and most importantly, revoked Executive Order 13440. Signed by President Bush. The Bush executive order had reinterpreted Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions and the obligations under the Torture Convention in ways that would permit harsh interrogations, waterboarding, and other measures which until then had been barred as constituting torture. And let me be clear, waterboarding is torture, and so are some of the other harsh methods that were countenanced under the Bush administration. They violate not only the basic laws of our land, but the core values of generations of Americans, tracing back to the very beginnings of this nation. The Eighth Amendment to the Constitution reads, excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. Placing someone's head underwater to the point of asphyxiation is both cruel and unusual. And it is, as Attorney General Eric Holder has stated, torture. The Attorney General stated in his confirmation hearing, if you look at the history of the use of that technique. And I'm quoting, used by the Khmer Rouge, used in the Inquisition, used by the Japanese, and prosecuted by us as war crimes. We prosecuted our own soldiers in Vietnam for using it. Waterboarding is torture. Now, just recently, in some interviews, former Vice President Cheney acknowledged again having supported those harsh interrogation techniques, and specifically waterboarding. It reminds me of the comment made by President Lincoln one time during our American Civil War when he was explaining to a group of soldiers his feelings toward the issue of slavery. You know, said Mr. Lincoln, whenever I hear anyone arguing for slavery, I feel a strong impulse to see it tried on him personally. When I hear someone condoning waterboarding, I feel the same strong impulse. If you go back in history, it really begins with the principle not to accept these kinds of practices. The Declaration of Independence stated that there are certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Torture and cruel and inhuman punishment do not fit in that framework. And a variety of Supreme Court rulings, at least from 1879 on, underscore that there are punishment and treatment of prisoners that are unacceptable, regardless of the objective, because they violate the Eighth Amendment. With respect to treatment of prisoners of war, George Washington stated clearly, and I quote, treat them with humanity, unquote. And Lincoln, even more definitively, I quote, military necessity does not admit of cruelty, nor of torture to extort confessions. The Geneva Convention, specifically Article 17 of the Third Geneva Convention and Common Article 3, outlaw torture. And our military officers traditionally have been the strongest defenders of the Geneva Conventions, and particularly Article 3, because it protects them when American soldiers are captured. Going back again to the post-war period, when the U.S. really was a leader in the crafting of human rights protections against the sovereign power of the Leviathan. It was Eleanor Roosevelt who chaired the Human Rights Commission that produced the Universal Declaration. She stated then, and I quote, this declaration would have great moral force and would say to the peoples of the world, this is what we hope human rights may mean to all people in the years to come. We have put down here the rights that we consider basic for individual human beings the world over to have. Without them, we feel that the full development of individual personality is impossible. Article 5 of the Declaration states that no one shall be subjected to torture or to cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment. But it was to be the preamble, really, to an international bill of human rights, of which future international covenants would carry legal treaty obligations. So Article 7 of the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights restates that prohibition against subjecting anyone to torture. The American Convention on Human Rights was signed by President Jimmy Carter on June 1, 1977. At that time, only 6 countries had signed and only 2 had ratified the American Convention, which had been approved in 1969 in Costa Rica. He signed it on June 1, 1977. I spent the next several years traveling throughout the hemisphere encouraging countries to ratify that document. And I'm pleased to say that by 1980, the document, the convention, came into force. 12 countries had ratified. Now, at that time, I felt absolutely fully empowered travel around the region and talk to foreign ministers and urge them and their governments to sign and ratify a prohibition against the use of torture. I would wonder today whether someone in my position today would be able to go around the world and make that same kind of argument without feeling at the very least some degree of hypocrisy. Article 5 of the American Convention states again, every person has the right to have his physical, mental, and moral integrity respected. No one shall be subjected to torture. But the key international achievement in this area has been the adoption of the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment. And again, the United States was part of the effort. From the beginning, commission chaired by Sweden that began in 1977 to draft the convention, the United States was a permanent part of that working group, through to its adoption in 1984 by the General Assembly. And then if one goes on, President Reagan then signed it in 1988 and submitted it to the Senate for its advising consent. And the first President Bush urged that the Senate ratify and provide that, urged that the Senate provide that advising consent and that it enact appropriate legislation. And then President Clinton, after the Senate had provided that advising consent in October 1994 and enacted U.S. what is now U.S. USC 2340, making it part of the U.S. Criminal Code, signed the documents of ratification. Republicans and Democrats alike, in terms of our history and of the principle, have espoused the view that torture is unacceptable. And last month, as I'm sure you discussed, in another action that I would say continues that principle, federal prosecutors successfully prosecuted the son of Liberian dictator Charles Taylor, who himself is now in prison at The Hague. Charles Taylor Jr. was sentenced to 97 years in prison for torture carried out in Liberia. There are dedicated civil servants in the U.S. government, in the Office of Special Investigations in the Justice Department's Criminal Division, in the Human Rights Division of ICE and the Department of Homeland Security, who make a career out of pursuing war criminals, human rights violators who have gotten into the United States, sometimes, and most of the time, by lying on their documents of entrance, and those like Chucky Taylor who torture. NGOs played a fundamental role in helping identify witnesses who would testify against Charles Taylor Jr. Unfortunately, if those actions represent what I would call the principle of our history, there's another darker history of exceptions, where torture and other measures of cruel and inhuman treatment have occurred, going back to the wars against Native Americans, to instances of abuse in Vietnam, to maintaining relationships during the Cold War with military regimes, sometimes including the training of police forces or military units of those regimes, some of whose graduates then we know were involved in torture, whether in Greece under the colonels, in the military dictatorships of Argentina, Chile, Paraguay, Uruguay, Nicaragua, Guatemala, the Philippines, Indonesia, South Korea. Where those exceptions have come to light, subsequently, I think they have been condemned by the American people. However, it is very hard to find anyone held accountable in those instances, except in the rarest of cases. Which brings me to the issue of impunity. There are three paths that I would argue need to be pursued in attempting to prevent torture in the future. First, we must seek to strengthen those national and international institutions whose responsibility is to monitor and enforce the Convention Against Torture and to seek greater adherence to the optional protocol, including the Special Rapporteur on Torture, the UN Committee Against Torture, the UN Voluntary Fund for Victims of Torture, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, and in relation to the Geneva Convention, the International Committee of the Red Cross. Second, there's a need for continuing efforts by human rights groups, civil society, the press, and public officials, which is why this conference is so important. The struggle is not over because there's a change in the White House, or because we have these formal institutions with an important legal mandate behind them. We, and I say we because it's all of us, must continue to speak out against the use of torture, whenever and wherever it occurs, and to demand access to places where it is alleged to occur. If we succeed in obtaining early access by attorneys, by the Red Cross, by human rights groups, by church leaders, by the press, then experience says we will reduce the use of torture. And finally, there's a path that needs to be explored much more effectively. And that path is how to reduce the level of impunity for those who are complicit in the use of torture. There's an internal Justice Department memorandum or report on the conduct of senior lawyers who approved waterboarding and other harsh interrogation tactics that apparently raises serious legal questions, at a minimum, as to whether they violated professional standards that apply to the Department of Justice. That report apparently is now being studied by Attorney General Holder. I would hope that the issue of professional standards would not end with an internal action of the Department of Justice, but would merit action by the American Bar Association to determine whether, by issuing opinions that flagrantly conflict with customary international law and our treaty obligations, such as those prohibiting torture, whether that action is consistent with the standards that one expects of members of the bar. In each instance that torture is used, the torturers justify it on the basis that the end is laudatory, and therefore the means are acceptable. Whether it's the military regimes who said they did it in order to prevent communists from coming to power, or whether it's the Soviet Union who said that they did it to prevent the counter-revolution, the end is always asserted as the reason to justify the means. And in the recent history, the end was the prevention of future terrorist acts, and the means was a pattern of harsh interrogations that was accepted by the Bush administration, and that the Obama administration and many military judges now are rejecting as constituting torture. The administration official now responsible to bring Guantanamo Bay detainees to trial has concluded in specific instances that the military tortured one of the individuals, and that case cannot be brought. Last October, a military judge, Stephen Henley, stated, "While the torture threshold is admittedly high, it is met in this case. The military commission concludes that the accused statements to the Afghan authorities were obtained by physical intimidation and threats of death, which under the circumstances constitute torture." What then happens to those who are involved, to those who authorize the acts? Senator Patrick Leahy and Congressman John Conyers have proposed creation of commissions to explore what actually was done over the past 8 years with respect to these issues and to determine what additional measures are required to prevent their repetition. Like the Church Committee, now nearly 30 years ago, I suspect that such an investigation will reveal not only more information about the excesses that we know, but more information about excesses that remain hidden behind the secrecy cloak of executive privilege and national security exceptions. Hopefully, the Obama executive orders and subsequent implementation in both the armed forces and the CIA will end what I would describe as an Alice in Wonderland legal framework that was crafted by some in the Bush Justice Department and legal counsel's office. The legal interpretation seemed to be according to the words of Alice, and I quote, "If I had a world of my own, everything would be nonsense. Nothing would be what it is, because everything would be what it isn't. And contrarywise, what is, it wouldn't be. And what it wouldn't be, it would." You see? And thus what had been torture no longer was, because one simply said that that which had constituted torture no longer did. You see? Now, for anyone who has known someone who has actually undergone torture, the impact on their lives and on their souls can never be forgotten, even years afterward. As you talk with the victims, it's seared into your own being even more when they still bear the physical marks of the torture that they've endured. In April 1974, I was a member of a small committee sent by Senator Ted Kennedy to Chile to investigate the human rights abuses there committed by the military junta. Pinochet regime believed that the end justified the means and guaranteed us access to prisoners. I had that access to a house in Calle Agostinas where doctors who had worked in Chile's Ministry of Health were held and tortured. In Calle Londres, where military intelligence ran another detention center, and a basketball arena where virtually all of the 140 prisoners previously had been tortured. to a cell in the Santiago Penitentiary where a dozen military officers were literally stuffed, all having suffered brutal treatment. The same cell where the general, whose daughter is now president of Chile, had been held before his death following torture 2 months earlier. When I returned to Washington, I wrote a summary memorandum to Senator Kennedy. The paragraph on torture reads, "Torture continues. Not only were we told by detainees, including about 80% of a group held in the basketball stadium, that they had been tortured during their interrogations, but we saw two young men who had been tortured as recently as 3 and 5 days earlier. One had fingernails swollen and fingertips burned from matches and needles inserted. Both had wrists rubbed raw from being hung for hours, and both were black and blue from being beaten. They also said they'd been tortured with electric shock during the interrogations. In all cases where we spoke with detainees, whether the detention centers were run by the Army, the Navy, or military intelligence, torture accompanied interrogations. We held hearings after that trip and were able to obtain bipartisan support to cut off all military aid and all government aid to Chile in the face of total opposition from the then Secretary. We also obtained the paroling into the United States of some 400 political prisoners from some of the jails that we visited. So for me, whenever the issue of torture arises, it is personal. I believe that the United States must hold true to the historical principle to respect the dignity of individual human beings, even of those who hate us. In so doing, the United States best preserves its ideals, best promotes its interests, and best protects its security. And the goal should be clear: an end to torture and an end to impunity for those who conspire, condone, or conduct torture. There must no longer be any exceptions. Thank you. If there are questions, I'm happy to take them. By the way, everything, this is my personal view, doesn't represent any organization that I belong to.
Do we have questions, or everyone is under the impression by the power? Listen, being a member of the Board of Trustees, now you have a president.
Thank you.
So I thank you for this. Continue informally. I thank you again to Mark Snyder for his presentation, and we will reconvene momentarily for the continuation of the conference. Thank you.